Welcome to Educated Conjecture, an Ipsos podcast that combines what the public thinks with what the experts think. Each week, Ipsos's Mike College and Sean Simpson are joined by an informed guest to discuss a current or emerging issue. Are Canadians believers or skeptics on the benefits that technology will bring to their lives over the next decade? The answer is, it depends. In this episode, Jesse Hirsch, futurist and co-founder of the Academy of the Impossible, joins hosts Mike and Sean to discuss the impact of generation, technology literacy, and trust in big tech when it comes to embracing the future. And now, on to the episode.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest, the next, this episode of Educated Conjecture. Sean, how are you today?
I'm well, Mike. Yourself?
Good. It's Monday, third Monday of the truckers' protest. Just for those, I don't know when we're going to release this, but just so the people are keeping score, the protest that wasn't going to last for more than a couple of days is now on its third week. Did you have a good weekend?
I did. Valentine's Day is today, actually.
It's today.
I went out and got flowers, and my florist actually chastised me because she hasn't seen me in 2 years. And then I was reminded that I hadn't got my wife flowers for 2 years.
That's excellent. Do you know what I got my wife?
Not flowers.
A snark.
What is a snark?
A snark, which is a tuner for a guitar.
Oh.
That you attach to a guitar, because I thought that it would last longer than flowers.
Hopefully. If it's quality.
It is not a very romantic gift. But anyway, we have Jesse Hirsch with us today. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Jesse is, you'll have heard the intro by now, everybody, but a futurist, technologist, observer of all things, also a, you say goat herd, or is it goat herder?
Goat herd, I think, like shepherd, right?
Or like shepherd, yeah.
But I'm a farmer.
You're a farmer in Eastern Ontario.
I'm one of a growing breed of futurist farmers, although once you sort of put those words together, you realize all farmers are futurists because they have to figure out what to plant and what to invest in.
Exactly.
So I kind of say I was a futurist who backed into farming, and here we are.
As someone who grew up on a small farm, I can vouch for that. You're always thinking ahead. You're always trying to figure out what's next. And you actually actively, if you're if you farm a specific crop, looking at the crops in Brazil a season ahead to determine how much you should. So it is quite something. My dad used to say if all you ever did was study soybeans, you could make a living on it. So, which he did because he grew them. So anyway,
right on.
Well, welcome, Jesse. We're not going to, we may talk about farming. Who knows what we're going to talk about? But we do a study, as you know, that Sean's familiar with, and we've done it we started in 2017, we skipped a year, and then we've done it every year since then, 19, 20, and 21, called Next. And it is, for anybody who's seen it, I would call it a mile wide and maybe 2 inches deep in terms of the way people look at the future. We asked people to cast forward 10 years, and when we laid this out initially, we were like, we just want to understand what do people think about the next 10 years. We'll dig down and then on specific issues. And we're like, no, we're going to cover the breadth from AI to technology to jobs to health and a whole range of things. So I'd like to refer back and forth and given you've thought a lot about this, Jesse, what you think, where we know our Canadians, well, not necessarily right or wrong, but where do you think Canadians are? And did anything surprise you? So the first one I'd like to talk about is we run a receptivity index to technology in general. And 2021, which is last year when we did this, December, it's the first time there's been a net positive and net negative, right? So in the past, people have leaned towards the negative. There have been more skeptics about the benefits of technology than those who are strong believers in the benefits of technology. We found really interesting that it's finally leveled off. A couple things that, you know, over the history of it, I'd like to point out is one, big gender gaps. Men far more likely to be more positive, far more likely to say, I'll share my data, my information, far less worried about privacy and concerns, and really a gap potentially in their willingness to adopt and move forward. And the second is when you talk to, we net people out as believers or skeptics, people who are believers, people who think things are going to go well, typically men and younger generations, say things like, I hope, I feel, I think. Where those who are skeptics say, I know someone who's lost their identity. I know someone who's lost their job. I'm personally having a hard time. So skeptics are really rooted in people who've had real experiences, and the believers are more hopeful and optimistic. So I just wondered what your thoughts were on sort of just general receptivity towards, you know, greater role of technology in our lives.
I mean, the biggest kind of trend I saw when I was looking at that part of the study was the role of literacy, right? The greater your literacy, the greater your confidence that any new technology will be an asset rather than a liability. And I've often sort of described the internet as this great big learning curve, because there's no finish line to the internet. There's no one who could say, all right, I figured it all out. There's always new technology. There's always new disruption. And if you feel like you're already underwater, then the prospect of new technology is frightening. It's intimidating because it means more learning for you to do. Versus for someone like myself who has advanced literacies and gets turned on by learning, I'm excited about the future. I'm excited about the new technology because to me, they're opportunities rather than threats. And it speaks to the enabling way that literacy unlocks agency, unlocks the ability to think that technology should bend to you rather than you having to bend to technology. Part of that, I think, is reflected in the confidence in the system, or even more crudely put, confidence in big tech, right? Whether you trust big tech, whether you feel that they are going to lead us to a better future, or whether you want more government regulation, whether you want more laws, whether you want more protections because you distrust big tech. It strikes me that these are the undercurrents. And because our political debates, our news has been filled with a lot of this, I think people are becoming more informed and more literate. And I think that's why you're seeing more of, to your point, a balancing off. But we may also be seeing a different kind of polarization, that the people who really fear it, they're getting even more afraid.
Yeah.
And the people who are excited, like the blockchain enthusiasts, they're doubling down in their zealotry, right? And they fundamentally feel that technology is the path to a more free, a more accessible, a better society. So I think this gets to my larger reaction to the study as a whole, to your question of, are Canadians right? You know, or how do Canadians align with everyone else's sort of sense of where the future is? And that brings up the paradox of perception, that our perception of the future influences the future, right? If we believe that AI is going to slouch towards Bethlehem to be born and become this great god, then by sheer act of belief, of faith, we are making that possibility, that future, even more likely. So what's fascinating to me about this study, and I think the first time I saw it was when we first met and you were presenting it as at a conference, is you're sort of looking at this of, are these people right? Because you're the researcher. And as the futurist, I'm looking at as, where are these people leading us? Right? Yeah. Consumers have so much power. Users have so much power on the internet that how they choose to use technology then gives me different glimpses into possible futures. And that's where trust, that's where literacy, that's where confidence has huge impacts, which if you scale this up to senior executives, if you scale this up to senior business leaders, in the last 6 months, contrary to my projections, contrary to my skills as a futurist, it's like every marketer, every chief marketing officer, every executive has decided the metaverse is a top priority, and they all need to spend millions of dollars developing metaverse capabilities so that they can have virtual experiences. A year ago, you would have said, hey, Jesse, is the pandemic going to create a virtual reality universe? I would have said, maybe, probably not. Now I'm like, yes. Now the metaverse is rising like a juggernaut, right? It's almost reaching an unstoppable force for the sheer reason of people's perception. That because people with money and budgets have decided that they are going to invest in the metaverse and they are going to manifest the metaverse will manifest.
I suddenly feel much better about being in the business of measuring people's perceptions, I'll tell you.
Well, there we're our own futurists then, maybe, Mike. One of the things that struck me as interesting about this distribution between skeptics and believers is that between our benchmark 2017 wave and 2019, the proportion of skeptics actually grew. And now, over the last 2 years, really since the pandemic, we've had a complete reversal of that trend, and more so, where the proportion of skeptics is declining and now, in fact, tied with the believers. What has changed in the last 2 years that reversed the trends of the previous 2 years? Is it COVID? Is it that we're now have been forced to deal with technology because it's been our lifeline? Or are there other things at play here, Jesse?
I think you're right. I think our relationship with the internet went from casual to monogamous. And that's an exaggeration.
Excellent
here on
Valentine's tie-in.
Yes,
thank you, Jesse.
I was very much trying to evoke a romantic metaphor. But I think what the pandemic has done for everybody, for regardless of where your literacy or access level is, if you haven't figured out how to find a meaning and joy from the internet during the pandemic, you're probably not doing so good right now. And I think everybody's done that. And the example I've been pointing to lately is the anti-vaxxers, right? Like, you know, to your point about this ongoing occupation of downtown Ottawa and other areas across Canada, it's an internet movement, right? These are people who have really high internet literacies, low scientific literacy, low medical literacy, but well, advanced internet literacy.
A little weak on the civic literacy too.
Yeah, agree. Absolutely. A little low on the civic literacy. But the point about the internet is the pandemic forced, you know, organizations to do the digital transformation that they were deferring, and it forced individuals to upgrade their internet skills and find community, find social connection, find meaning, find purpose. You know, the bad example of that is the anti-vaxxers, but obviously there's lots of great examples of that. And I think that's the big reason why the skepticism has been mitigated or moderated, is because we now have tangible examples of human benefit, of human connection, that the pandemic all forced us to adapt and accommodate. And I don't want to discount the business side to this, because I think the businesses that right now that are thriving, that are prospering, that are rocketing in phenomenal ways that I'm witnessing, are the businesses that have fully integrated digital transformation and have decided that they're not only going to do business like the internet, but at the speed of the internet. So it's not just remote work. It's to back to our point about skepticism, it's full integration of technology, full exploration of technology, full experimentation with technology. So it's almost as if these businesses have said, if I'm going to survive, if I'm going to prosper, I have to put this skepticism aside. I'll still employ it, but it's almost as if that is the secondary and the primary is adoption, right? Because it's adapt or die. That is kind of the way in which the pandemic has changed our relationship to the internet.
Do you think it's easier for, I like the idea of the adoption. Do you think it's easier to adopt when you don't have a legacy system? Like that those that are starting anew actually have an advantage over those who have had a traditional system that they have to figure out how to morph?
I mean, yes, but, and there's a big but, like the obvious answer is it's always easier to start from scratch. Mm-hmm. But that means you have no wisdom. That means you have no pain. That means you have no trauma, right? Which is what makes us human. It's what makes organizations, I think, smart and capable. Honestly, I say this as a consultant who, you know, has been there, done that, and hated every moment of it. Those who blame legacy systems for their inability to adapt are finding weak excuses that distract from the actual problems. I think actually legacy systems should be seen as assets. And the smart organizations who have translated those assets and upgraded those assets into the new world, they will be the powerhouses because of their wisdom, because of their experience, because of their capabilities. And on an abstract level, there are elements of the Canadian federal government who have done this, right? Who have legacy systems, and they've translated these systems into new systems, and they're making amazing gains and amazing progress. Unfortunately, the exception to the rule in the mess that is the federal government. But the point is, they are the king of legacy systems. And there are examples amidst that ecosystem that kind of prove the idea that, yeah, it's easier to start from scratch, but nothing beats wisdom and nothing beats the pain of past mistakes that you will never make again.
Well, so my dad used to say that to me all the time. I'm giving you the benefit of the mistakes I made. So
I mean, you know, as a tangent, but a relevant one. The only way that a city kid like me, who spent his entire life benefiting from the convenience of contemporary civilization, who could move into the country and become a farmer overnight without parents, without any mentorship, is YouTube, right? That all the world's knowledge is at my fingertips. And I now have access to not only guys like your dad, right? But like all around the world. So that's what I mean by our relationship with technology has changed. And I think that it has really pushed our skepticism back, because once you tap into it, the available empowerment, the available knowledge and wisdom is intoxicating. And I think that the pandemic forced everyone to tap into that. And they've all been kind of, you know, tuned in, turned on, and they're not dropping out, but at least they're starting to connect with the larger message of the internet.
We saw it very much in our data from 5 years ago when we first concocted this next study, and that is the gap between men and women. You know, I think everybody sort of expects to see generation gaps, older people less likely to adopt technology, etc. But just as clear in the data is a gender gap between men and women, and doesn't matter their age, women are always significantly more skeptical, less likely to be comfortable with technology, to believe it, you know, it's the way forward, essentially. How do we close that gap? How do we, you know, are there specific programs that we need to design for women in building that literacy and comfort level? Because I suspect that given the accelerated pace of change, that gap will only widen as we go forward.
I think you're correct that it is a widening gap. And I think without, if the status quo, that gap will become dangerously wide. And I think it's worth pointing out that the pandemic has had a huge hit against women in the workforce, because many have had to focus to care labor, right? Taking care of kids, taking care of elders. And so I think you raise an important question that I'm going to answer with a very, not crass, but blunt metaphor. Because I don't actually think this is an issue of literacy. I think if you were to look at literacy from a gendered perspective, you'd find that overall women have higher literacy, higher internet literacy than men do. And to your point, that trust issue is profound and getting worse. I think it's an issue of power. And I'll put it bluntly by saying, what if the internet is creating a new regime, a new society, a new means of governing that society? And right now, men are running it. Right? Look at the blockchain bros. Look at big tech. Look at the developer community. Look at who makes the decisions around how our technology is developed and used, and it's men. And so women would have very good reason to distrust that, if not reject that, and go, that's not a world I want to live in. That's not a regulatory environment that I feel protects me or serves my interests. And, you know, there are companies like Twitter who have kind of recognized this, and are now putting in a lot of mechanisms and governance that I think include women and start to try to address this culture gap, this trust gap, that are this new regime that is emerging does not yet have women in power, and it should, right? Does not provide a means by which women can participate meaningfully in influencing policy and governance decisions, right? Like, I'll be blunt. Facebook, aka Meta, is a dictatorship because it's controlled by one person, Mark Zuckerberg. He's the controlling shareholder, right? The board of directors of Meta, while it certainly has oversight, does not effectively have governance control of the organization because it's all owned by Mark Zuckerberg. That's a good reason to say that's why I don't think as a woman I would be protected there, right? Versus there are other ways in which to look at governance, to look at the way in which women should be in power of the technology. And to their credit, there are feminist blockchain projects. There are feminist cryptocurrency projects. You know, one that I've been looking at is called Disco.coop. which is distributed cooperatives, right? So using blockchain technology to create cooperative movements that are often women run. So I think it's an issue of power and an issue of governance. And I think the way to change that is to democratize technology so that everyone in society gets to have a say as to how we create and use this stuff.
And I don't know the numbers on this. I should know before I say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. Do you think there's a... Sean's smiling because he's probably heard me do that before. What's the impact of gaming? Because, and I'll just be completely anecdotal. I have a son, mid-20s, and... The first time I realized the impact of gaming on him, I think the first time was I walked down, he was playing, and he just started to explain to me how the game worked, and really it was a lesson in supply and demand, at pure economics, right? And I was like, okay, so maybe there's some value there. And then one other day I said, you got to come up, it's time to do something. He said, I can't, I'm playing a game. And I was like, well, walk away. And he turned to me and he goes, because I played baseball, or I did when I was younger, and he said, when you were in the middle of a baseball game, can you leave in the fifth inning? And just leave. And I'm like, well, no, of course I can. I have my peers and I'm playing and I'm playing position. He goes, same thing, Dad. I'm playing with these folks. And if I leave, it ruins the game. And I get, and he literally went through and said, I get a mark against me. Some people won't play with me. People like it. Like the house is burning. Yes, but I can't just decide. And it's so that I don't just leave when I'm losing. Right. That, you know, and so he built, there's all these social norms that he really learned in gaming. And I'm sure that the stats skew towards men rather than women, at least early on. Maybe it's balancing out now. But I'm just wondering if this generation of, say, mid-20s to mid-30s in particular, men, they got 20 years more experience on online than a lot of people do.
And let me sort of answer your question kind of in reverse.
It wasn't really a question, I don't think.
Allow me to respond by backing out of the trap I suspect you set. So for my parents, you know, rock and roll, Bob Dylan, that was the milieu that they grew up in, right? That was the culture that defined who they were and who their friends were. For me, it was hip hop. It was Public Enemy, right? It was, you know, Wu-Tang Clan. That was who my friends, that's the culture we grew up in. Today, it's video games, right? And it's remarkable how deep the video game culture is. I spent the first year of the pandemic studying Twitch and looking at Twitch as a video. I mean, it's more than video games, but it's a video game live streaming platform. I was interested from the perspective of a media scholar. But I was also, it was a foray for me as an old man to explore video game culture. So Gamergate was a huge political war fought over women's role and participation in the video game movement. It was arguably the predecessor to the anti-vax movement and the predecessor to QAnon, because all of the tactics, all of the methods, and arguably all of the same players, to your point about young men who grew up in those battles and then went on to support Trump and then went on to fight for their freedom against the evil pharmaceuticals and Dr. Fauci, you know, these are the same keyboard warriors. And it's interesting how the video game world has been an incubator of a very misogynist, a very toxic culture. Women have been fighting in the front lines. There are a lot of women video game developers, producers, players. And because gaming culture is more than youth culture now. It started as youth culture. I would argue it is now the most mainstream culture, right? You know, if you were to say that social media is the meta culture and that within social media there's subcultures, I would argue that gaming is by far the biggest. And there are a lot of women fighting tooth and nail for their place in that culture. So maybe to your point, that's where we're going to see breakthroughs when it comes to these governance issues, when it comes to participation, especially when it comes to media images and representation, which is another big part of kind of culture and how it's developed. But the problem, to bring it back full circle, is like, you know, our cognitive bias is we're researchers, right? So we're all people who like actively take an interest in our society and we're actively curious because that's essentially our profession. Unfortunately, most adults are clueless about gamer culture,
right?
And do not understand it, to your point, yell at their kids to stop playing the game, not just when it's in the fifth inning, but when they're in the act of stealing the base. Like, imagine you're Ricky Henderson running from first to second, and your mom goes, "Ricky, you didn't clean your room." Like, that is literally what these kids go through, because their parents have no respect, no appreciation for the social fabric that these kids have created. And so I would encourage you guys, I think it would be, I think you'd find business opportunities if you were start to do the kind of market research you guys do, but talk to gamers, right? Because here's the interesting part of gamers. They hate the gaming industry, right? There is no intermediary between the billion-dollar companies that make it and the users who use it, right? As far as I know, there's no company like yourself who, as a trusted intermediary between those groups, tries to help them understand and trust each other, because they don't understand each other and they sure don't trust each other.
There's our next corporate reputation study, Sean.
Perfect. Perfect.
Trust in gaming.
Look at a couple more stats in the next study, Jesse. Obviously, you know, that index of pessimists and optimists is comprised of individual components. So I just want to read a couple of those out to you and get your take on them. 46% of Canadians believe that new technologies will result in more good than harm. So 46%, that's up 8 points, but still a minority. 43%, up 12 points, say that all things considered, advances in technology are going to lead to more and better jobs for Canadians. But if 43% agree, again, it's only a minority, meaning a majority are still a little bit nervous about this. And in fact, 55% believe that advances in technology are going to create mass unemployment. And that one's only down a couple of points in the last 2 years. So the belief here is that this disruption is going to create a lot of unemployment, that the benefits are going to be uneven. Are Canadians thinking clearly about this? Are they right? Is there the potential for this to happen, and how do we avoid it?
I mean, the short answer is yes. And I've been doing this kind of joke lately where people say, "Hey, Jesse, you know, is blockchain the future infrastructure of our digital economy, or is it just a scam?" And I always answer, yes. Right? There's no reason for these things to be mutually exclusive, in that, right, unfortunately, the way in which our technology tends to be deployed, adopted, integrated, is it isn't unequal. Right? This is sort of the original frame I presented, that those with advanced literacies, those organizations with capabilities, those of us who are curious, we're really good at identifying a new tool, a new disruption, and either adapting or identifying the opportunity it presents and acting accordingly. So we benefit, we become enriched, we are empowered by these tools. But there are many people who, because of lower literacy or because they are in difficult economic straits, are not in a position to take advantage of that opportunity, are not in a position to adapt to the disruption that the technology has introduced and therefore move forward. Because the one piece I will disagree with, and, you know, the beauty about being a futurist is, just like weather people, we're consistently wrong. And that is the general expectation.
Pollsters, too, actually.
Right, right. So we're almost like a meta category of people who everyone recognizes are mostly wrong. But when we're right,
it's sweet.
That's when everyone goes, okay, right. That's why those guys do what they do. And the one area that I'm a bit of a dissident is, I reject the whole premise that technology will lead to unemployment. I feel that there is a correlation between technology and unemployment. And that speaks to literacy, it speaks to the role of education, it speaks to the role of retraining. But A, there is overwhelming empirical evidence that automation has never led to mass unemployment. It does lead to displacement. It does lead to people being left behind. But allow me to take two examples that are often bandied about when it comes to AI resulting in massive unemployment. The first, ironically enough, is truck drivers, right? For a long time, people have been saying automated vehicles, self-driving trucks, we won't need truck drivers anymore. And I've been arguing the opposite. right? I've been arguing, in fact, if you look at the role of the truck driver, who 30, 40 years ago, that was a mechanic, because when the truck broke down on the side of the road, they had to fix it. But now, thanks to predictive analytics, now thanks to AI and smart systems, trucks don't break down anymore, right? We have preventative maintenance. We have sensors. We can make sure that the rigs are always operating. So in essence, the truck driver is now a bureaucrat because their primary job is compliance and forms, right? Like operating the vehicle is increasingly not a difficult job. What's difficult is regulatory compliance. And that is becoming the job of the truck driver. Further, what you may see is increased capacity. So instead of one person operating one trailer, it could be one person operating a fleet of five trucks that are all automated. And it's that one person's job to oversee the algorithms, to make sure that when a deer jumps into the road, the AI responds accordingly, right? Or if it's snowy or whatever. So the human's role will change as a result of the technology. But short of this vaccination issue, every logistics company I've seen across the country cannot hire enough truck drivers, right? The supply chain crisis in the United States was created by a labor shortage of truck drivers. The issue is not mass unemployment. It's the opposite. The issue is increased capacity. And how do we maintain, how do we attract people to do the job if you're just a bureaucrat instead of a mechanic, right? And then the other example I like to cite is the whole white collar idea, right? The idea that AI is now getting into really advanced intellectual work, and maybe doctors and accountants and lawyers should be scared for their jobs. So I take law, right? There's phenomenal, because law is such a high margin, big buck business, there's so many AI companies active in the legal industry. And these are amazing, like phenomenal AI companies that are achieving just like breakthrough success, like things, you know, AIs that can predict the outcome of litigation and therefore crowdfund for class action lawsuits because they know there's going to be a payout on the end. You know, AIs that parse contracts into accessible English so that everybody can understand contracts and they can be accessible. You know, there's all sorts of examples of how AI is transforming law. But do you really think we're going to see less lawyers? Right. And the example I give, imagine you took 3 days of labor for a lawyer and you crunch that down into 5 minutes. That just means you got a whole lot more clients to accommodate. So instead of less lawyers, we're going to see more litigation because the access to law, the access to suing people is going to be radically reduced. Right. So this is where I think the whole notion of mass unemployment, this is the one example where I don't blame the people because this is the narrative that they've been fed by society. But it's an example of something that is currently not grounded in any empiricism at all. But it could come true. Like if everybody continued to believe that AI will result in massive unemployment, then we're going to get massive unemployment for, I mean, I could come up with a bunch of reasons, but the easiest might be because people don't look for a job because they don't think they're qualified because everyone told them they're not qualified because they don't have a degree in data science.
So there's another question in the study on AI. It's improved or lower. It's going in the right direction, I think. 57% now say that they're worried that as more and more of everything, programs, the world relies on AI, people will start to act more like computers and will lose human empathy. It was 71% 3 years ago. So is that, should we be worried about that? I mean, people are moving away from it. And I think the part of that is they're getting more comfortable with AI in general and going, I'm not as scared as I was 3 years ago. But are we still concerned that people are going to be a little more black and white and computer-like?
Absolutely. And I think this is a great example again of the paradox of perception, that you know the idea that AI is this great power, because it is, right? It's a very powerful tool that can be used in very powerful ways. I think everybody senses that. Like even if your comprehension of AI is very fundamental, there is a recognition that just like a big tank or a big bomb, it is a powerful tool. And I think that is a legitimate reason for distrust, to wonder who controls this tool, right? How is my information being used to build this tool? And I think that motivates a lot of people. But on the flip side, like, I love Gmail. And I love that Gmail's now writing my emails for me. I don't even have, like, the accuracies for all. So there is a seductive side to AI that I think is working for a lot of people. You know, TikTok, for example, the accuracy of the TikTok algorithm at first absolutely terrified me until I realized how fantastic it was. And, you know, this is the paradox of AI, that really effective AI can and should be powerful, seductive, and empowering, and should not be a source of fear. But the myth of AI is interesting, right? This is the idea that AI will become conscious, that AI will declare independence from humanity and become an existential threat. And that's a great example of, if enough people believe it, it will become true. Not literally true in the case of AI will come alive, but a dictator would use it as a puppet, right? Like, you know, if I was a demagogue who seeked power, and there are all these people who are worshiping a machine, well, I would create a puppet machine, just like the Wizard of Oz, that got everybody to follow my bidding. Like, that's political science 101. So that's where we have a danger, that the more people who have that belief, the more ripe it is for someone like Elon Musk to exploit that belief. And to your point, you know, these individuals currently occupying our nation's capital with very low medical literacy, very low scientific literacy, very low civic literacy. I describe them as having very high internet literacy, and they sure do look like the bots on the internet who are posting nonsense, except they're in real life amplifying the nonsense that bots have fed them on the internet, that they've read and believed, and now they're acting out on the streets of Ottawa, even though all the residents of Ottawa are saying, go home, buddy. None of that is true. Here's the proof. Here's the science. And these people don't care, because bots on the internet have inspired them to fight for their freedom. So it's a paradox. Right? You know, who are the bots? Who aren't? I don't know.
Interesting parallel with, I don't know if you saw the Super Bowl, the GM last night, GM ad with Mike Myers taking over the world through electronic vehicles. So you're get demagogue. I'm going to fix it so I can run it. It was actually a nice play. That's interesting. Okay, I want to shift gears to talk about data. Because one of the things that comes out of the study is a softening around privacy. People are still concerned about it. But a fairly, and something that I don't think is talked enough about, is who owns data. 3/4 of the population say data collected by governments is owned by the citizens they collect it from. 3/4 of the same number, 74%, say data collected by businesses is owned by the consumers they collected it from. And yet, people willingly give away their data all the time. There don't seem to be any value attached to it. What are your thoughts on, like, privacy is one issue, I get that. But the ownership of my data stream that is so valuable, that collectively with mine and Sean's and yours and Alan's and everybody else's, the world runs on it. Yet I get nothing for it. I guess I get really good TikTok. And I get some really cool things from Netflix. I get to see things over and over again, and my Spotify account is filled largely with roots Americana blues related music. But other than that, I don't get any monetary value.
So I want to push back on the value part of it in a moment, but allow me to tease something you said earlier, in that I think, like most things in life, you know, it's all about possession, not ownership, right? I think we have been misled to believe that the ownership of data is relevant when the control and possession of data is what's relevant, right? And that is, I think, to your point of what's so problematic about the way in which people freely give away their data, because they ain't getting it back, right? And they're not in a position to do anything about it once they've given it away. They've lost control. And I think that is where there's both a lamenting, but also there's a larger desire for redress, for potentially government regulation, and or maybe a new business model, right? Because to go back to the blockchain bros, one of the scenarios they're offering that is tantalizing to people is – you can control your data even after it's been placed out there, right? And the blockchain people are trying to imagine social networks in which users are fundamentally in control and users exercise greater agency of their data and who has access to it. And I'll give one hypothetical example that I would love to see happen, right? Let's pretend in the future I decide to travel again. And, you know, it's a dangerous world from a health perspective. And I want to carry with me my health information, right? I want possession of my health information so that whatever happens to me, because I happen to have a complicated health issue, that I want to be able to give that health information to a clinic, to a nurse, to a doctor, anywhere in the world, instantly and securely. And I want to be the one who controls that consent, right? Rather than have to contact my doctor back in Canada, rather have to go through someone else. So the idea that we as individuals could both be in possession and control of our information and exchange that information for value, for services, for, you know, government authentication, when and where we need it, it is a very powerful proposition. And that's part of what the, you know, the blockchain buddies are kind of working on. But I think to bring our conversation back full circle, we are talking about a literacy issue. That if you think about yourself as a participant in the marketplace and you have a valuable asset, your data, and the marketplace is tempting you with all sorts of offers for your data, well, ideally, you know, you want to be able to bargain to favor yourself, right? You want to be able to engage the marketplace so that you're not always scammed, but that you're actually getting, to your original point, value for your data. And that's where I think we have a paradox. I think everybody does value their data. They just don't know how to exercise or even identify that value, right? They haven't been given the tools. They haven't been given the capabilities. I say this because I do, right? I always know how to exercise my data. And I always laugh, you know, when I'm at a this is so pre-pandemic, at a restaurant or engaging with, you know, whatever. And they always want my feedback, right? They always want me to fill out a survey. They always want me to, you know, if there's something wrong, tell them how to fix it. And I was like, I'm a consultant. Would you like to know my rates? Right? Like, I'm not going to give my labor for free. What are you talking? Like, giving me a chance to win a gift card? No, that's not in my interest.
Yeah.
I value my labor. I value my time. I value my data. And I will exercise that value in the marketplace. Thank you very much. Well, I wish other people had a similar esprit de corps.
Well, our focus group participants generally do.
Yeah. Because they've been trained.
Get a check. Yeah.
Yeah.
One final question for you, Jesse, from me. 61% of Canadians believe there will be a massive personal data leak that will lead a top 10 company to ruin. Do you think that's likely to happen as well, or are companies just so sophisticated that they're impenetrable?
No, we live in a state of insecurity. I mean, a whole other tangent we could take is, you know, what's going on in cybersecurity right now, which I have recently escalated with the impending invasion of Ukraine. We are now in what I'm calling the cyber wars, in which the primary battlefield is the internet. It's certainly spilling over into the real world, like downtown Ottawa, but states are actively attacking each other and their industries via the internet, right? Through hacking, through espionage, through data breaches. So no, companies do not presently really have the capacity to defend themselves. Some more than others, sure. But let's not forget here in Canada, hospitals and how health information is incredibly valuable. So I do agree with the premise. Like I would say the other half to that context or that concept is government regulations, like fines, right? If there are, like, the European Union, right, is going to be increasingly ratcheting up data protection fines so that, yes, if a company has a spectacular outage, they will be bankrupt because the fines and penalties will be so onerous. And I welcome such a regulatory regime, because I do think we need greater data protections. But allow me to throw a curveball right back. And this is not a well-developed curveball, so I've got a little spit on it, so it's got a little extra action. What if data fundamentally is not a commodity? What if we have made a concept? What if saying that data is the new oil was such a catastrophic conceptual error that it distracted us down a philosophical chain which has hit a dead end? Because as we've rolled it back, what if data is not a commodity? What if it's a social good? What if data is inseparable from the subject, the person? And what if our perception of the digital marketplace is wrong? Because the way that regulators, for example, keep mischaracterizing it is the idea that companies like Facebook, who I still refuse to call Meta, actually sell data to people when they don't. Right? What Facebook does with all their data is build products and services with that data. But Facebook has insisted repeatedly in congressional testimony that they sell their data to nobody. And I would argue that's true of all these companies, Spotify, Google, Netflix, all of them. They are not at all interested in selling that data to anybody. That's not their business. Their business is they build products and services off of that data, right? Analytics, advertising, insights, content, whatever, right? A wide growing range of stuff that you can build if you happen to have a growing sea of data. So this idea that data is valuable is absolutely true as an asset, right? It's absolutely true as, you know, a body that you have. But as a commodity, no. And from a regulatory perspective, if the people like me are correct and successful at advancing this notion that data is a social good, then the state might start reclaiming it. The state might say you're not allowed to hold that data anymore because it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the people who believe that it's theirs, who believe they own it. And even though they gave it to you, they actually didn't because they still possess it. Jesse's birthday is still his. Right? It still exists on his body because that's what was born. Again, a little crazy. I'm still working this out. But I think that puts a lot of these companies in a position of liability
question. That's very interesting. It might challenge some of their models down the road.
Yes.
I have one more question. It's about Jesse Hirst, not about the data. How do you go from Toronto downtown? And don't get this wrong, because I like Eastern Ontario. We've discussed this. To a farm in Eastern Ontario, you could have gone to Southwestern Ontario, where some of the best, richest farmland in the world is, yet you ended up in the place where some of the best rocks are.
Yes.
that's beautiful. But
and my property in particular, you know, the first farmers who tried to work this land like 120 years ago, it's hilarious, because you could see all they did was find rocks.
Yeah,
because there's all these fences made out of rocks. You're just like, every one of those was like a curse. We're just like, Oh man, another rock. Yeah. And they put it on this fence, right? So a few answers to your question. Number one, money. Unfortunately, I was a little bit behind the wave of people converting their Toronto real estate into Ontario farmland, and real estate prices radiating out of Toronto had, in my view, and this was pre-pandemic, because, oh my God, has the pandemic accelerated this? Mm-hmm. But pre-pandemic, I did not want to pay those inflated prices. Right. I already felt that Southwestern Ontario, like I was looking Grey County, Bruce County,
yep.
You know, because I like rocks. I just couldn't do it, right? So in getting 4 hours out of the city, the land here was still really quite affordable. And even at that time, Ottawa, as a city, the real estate prices were still way below market value, which is why the pandemic's impact on the Ottawa real estate market has been outsized, because it went from way low to way high because it was underpriced, and then it went overpriced because now all the government employees can work from home.
Yep.
So they all wanted to buy bigger homes. So one issue was money, that it was just the nature of the real estate market. The second issue was policy, politics, right? I'm interested in governance. I feel that the technology and the future of technology, I felt it was going to play out in Ottawa. I didn't expect the pandemic to basically make Ottawa irrelevant now. Someone should tell the occupiers that Ottawa is now irrelevant, but the government's now virtual. So you don't actually have to be in Ottawa anymore to participate in policy and the political process. But the third question is, we were interested in farmland that was undervalued and neglected, and to your point, rocky. Because we're practitioners of agroecology and kind of a new climate change-centric approach to agriculture. We're predominantly an animal farm, a dairy farm in terms of goat and sheep, and we do now have one cow that we are slowly but surely going to knock up. But we're interested in making soil and okay. like in using the poop from the animals to make soil and to look at new ways of agriculture that don't require the super rich soil that right now is priced at a premium, right? Because the other thing climate change is doing is it's making agriculture a premium business because everyone's anticipating food scarcity. Right. And everyone's anticipating the scarcity of growing land. So I, as a technologist, if I think about my skills is understanding technology and translating technology, I felt agriculture is where technology is going to have a huge impact. And there's a little bit of prejudice to what I'm about to say. My assessment of the agricultural sector is that it's not entirely technologically literate. And that as someone who has a high level of technological literacy and low level of agricultural literacy, it would be easy for me to acquire the latter and share the former in a way that allows me to be of value to the sector and the broader industry as a whole. So I did, as an aside, I registered the business name Ottawa Valley Smart Farms, which is one of the iterations of my identity as I explore agricultural robotics and AI and surveillance on the farm.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Maybe we'll have you back sometime to talk about the advancement in smart farming or whatever we decide to.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts for another episode of Public Opinion and Informed Insights. If you have a topic you'd like to see covered on an upcoming episode, please send us an email at publicaffairs@ipsos.com. That's publicaffairs@ipsos.com.